Hi, this is John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, which you can find online at breakpoint.org. The Colson Center is pleased to support listening in. Enjoy the program.
I'm Warren Smith, and today you're listening in on my conversation with journalist Les Sillars as we discuss his new book, Intended for Evil, a survivor's story of love, faith, and courage in the Cambodian killing fields.
I do have some sympathy for the American military who were looking at this and they're saying, well, either we bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail or our troops who are in a foreign country trying to, you know, do something worthwhile, more of them will die because of this.
Regular readers of World Magazine probably already know the name Les Sillars. Over the years, he's written many stories for the magazine while simultaneously pursuing a career as a professor of journalism at Patrick Henry College in Northern Virginia. But until now, he's never written a book. That may be because he's never encountered a story quite like that of Radha Monicum. Radha Monicum became a Christian as a young man in his native Cambodia. But when Khmer Rouge forces overtook the country's capital, Phnom Penh, in 1975, Radha became an eyewitness to one of the great horrors of the 20th century. More than 1.7 million Cambodians, including most of Radha's own family, died of starvation, disease, and mass murder in what came to be called the Killing Fields of Cambodia. When Les Sillars heard about Radha's story from his Patrick Henry College colleague, David Aikman, a distinguished journalist in his own right, he quickly felt compelled to tell the story himself. I traveled to Northern Virginia to hear Les Sillars tell both Radha's story and the story of how and why he came to write this book. Les, first of all, welcome to the program. And I should say that I'm not going to be a completely objective journalist here. For one, I've known you for a while. We've been colleagues at World. And secondly, I really admired the book. I mean, it was just really well done, deeply reported, elegantly written. And so thank you for that. Intended for Evil, a survivor's story of love, faith, and courage in the Cambodian killing fields. And that survivor specifically is Radha Monicum.
Monicum, yep.
Monicum. It's funny, when you read it, you don't know how it's pronounced. But tell me about Radha.
Sure. Radha is a guy who was raised in Cambodia. He's of Indian ethnic descent, but his father came to Cambodia when he was a young man. And so Radha was raised in Phnom Penh, and he became a Christian in 1973. His family is Hindu, but he became a Christian in 1973, just 2 years before the Khmer Rouge took over Cambodia. And then he survived the regime. It's one of the most horrible, most totalitarian regimes in modern history. It was responsible for the deaths of almost a quarter of its population, 1.7 million people. No other regime can say that. Of course, Mao and Stalin killed far more people. But no other regime has killed nearly a quarter of its own people.
You know, and I think a lot of people don't know that story very well, especially probably people today. You mentioned in the beginning of the book that your exposure to that story was seeing the movie The Killing Fields, that about the New York Times reporter Sidney Schomburg, which, by the way, that movie was important to me in my life in wanting to become a journalist. But even those of us who are old enough to remember that movie when it came out, that memory's faded. And of course, there are many millions of people, especially Americans, that just don't remember Pol Pot and the killing fields and the war in Cambodia and all of that.
Yeah, absolutely. It was a real surprise to me. You know, I didn't even know the movie well. I had this hazy recollection of this movie. I saw it when I was maybe in college or maybe a few years afterwards, and I really didn't know anything about it. I had heard of Pol Pot, heard of this brutal dictator, but I mean, honestly, I'm not entirely sure I could have picked out Cambodia on a map, you know, 5 years ago.
When 1.7 million people are killed, as reportedly Stalin said, we don't know exactly where this quote comes from, but that, you know, a million deaths is a statistic, but one death is a tragedy, which to me was part of the brilliance of your book, that you chose to tell one story. You chose to tell the meta narrative through the story of one man. I'm assuming that was an intentional strategy on your part.
Well, honestly, it was my intention was not to tell the story of the Khmer Rouge. My intention was to tell Radha's story. You know, when I was introduced to Radha by a friend, and we can talk about that in a minute. But I was going to tell Radha's story and then provide only enough background to make sense of Radha's story, to understand really what he was going through. And so when I first started to look into it, you know, as I say, I had no idea about the Khmer Rouge or what they'd done. But I made contact with Radha, and then I started to read about them, you know, and I found them both like horrifying and fascinating. And I'm thinking to myself, you know, there is a great story here. Well, it's a great story, but it's a horrible time and a horrible, it's a horrible era for Southeast Asia. And I think that people need to know more about what went on in that era, because these things ought not to be forgotten.
Yeah, well, exactly right. So I know a little bit about how you found out about this story. David Eggman, who is a famous, at least famous to some of us, right, a journalist and reporter for Time Magazine, who's now on the faculty here with you at Patrick Henry College. And he just sort of in passing in the hallway told you about this story?
Well, he had actually, there had been some friends of his had started up a contest for, it was a magazine article contest, and he had, and they said it was kind of in his honor, and so they said they were going to, they had a number of stories that they had, and they wanted to be written as magazine articles, and then the winner would be published, you know, and it was to encourage young journalists. And this was one story that hadn't actually been handed out. And so I'm kind of walking by him in the hallway one day, and David says to me, he says, "Hey, you should call this guy." And, you know, his name is Radhamanikam. You know, he lives in Seattle. Here's his email address. And as I say, I knew nothing about the Khmer Rouge. I had no idea where this might lead. But I email Radha, you know, and we set up a phone call, and he's telling me just this incredible stuff, you know, I mean, about his forced marriage, about losing most of his family to starvation and beatings. He saw people killed in front of, like right in front of him. And I'm going, oh my goodness, this is quite the story. And so I promised to do some reading and call him back. And, that was in the fall of 2013. And so I was doing all this reading over the fall of 2013. I was coming to the realization that this was a really incredible story that really should be told. And so in January of 2014, we started to talk every week, you know, and every week he would tell me something, you know, that just made my jaw drop. You know, I had to go down to Walmart and get a new jaw after a while.
Oh, right.
Because it was just one thing after another.
Well, and at some point, the story gripped you enough so that you decided you wanted to write a book about it. And I wanted to ask you a little bit about that because, you know, I've written a few books. And, you know, Churchill has this famous saying about whenever you start writing a book, it's a beautiful romance. And then by the time you get to the end of it, it's a mistress you wish you could get rid of, you know. And I mean, probably not a Christian worldview informing that quote. But the point is that you had successfully avoided writing a book for most of your career. I mean, you've been a prolific journalist, you know, magazine and other kind of journalism, and of course, you know, a professor here at Patrick Henry for a long time. It must have been something really special that gripped you to sort of turn this story into your first book.
Well, I had wanted to write a longer narrative nonfiction piece for a long time. I've been teaching this narrative nonfiction class at the college since about probably the last 6 or 8 years, and I would read these incredible journalists like, you know, Tom Wolfe. And said to myself, yeah, you know, I want to be able to write something like that one day. I picked up Laura Hillenbrand's Unbroken, you know, sometime shortly after it came out. And I read that and I said to myself, you know, if I ever write anything half that good, I'll call myself a journalist and retire, you know. And so I'd wanted to do this for a while. And when the opportunity came along to try and apply some of these same techniques we've been talking about in class, I said, yeah, I'm going to give this a shot.
Well, congratulations, because in my view, you have written something at least half as good as Laura Hillenbrand's book. So, and in fact, I would like to ask you, just to kind of get a taste of it, to read a paragraph less of your book. And I'm going to try not to interrupt you, but I do want to hear a little about your process. But this is a paragraph on page 51 of your book.
Radha and his father went into the apartment and closed the curtains. Later that morning, they saw them. Squads of Khmer Rouge soldiers walking in single file down their street. They wore loose black cotton pants that came down to mid-calf and shirts with buttons and breast pockets, often called pajamas. A black Chinese cap and a red and white check-patterned krama, a sturdy traditional Cambodian garment used as a bandana or child carrier or other useful purposes, either around their waists or necks. Most had Ho Chi Minh sandals cut from old tires on their feet. They looked very young, younger than Radha's 22 years, and also thinner and much, much tougher. They were mostly filthy, reflecting months or years of warfare in the jungle. They didn't smile, and they didn't act like victors. Ravi, that's Radha's brother, who was 17 by then, thought the Khmer Rouge were much more frightening than the Republican troops. The communists looked grim, menacing, and unpredictable. Many carried rocket launchers or AK-47s slung from shoulder straps.
Well, that's dramatic and foreboding. At the same time, this is fairly near the beginning of the book, so the foreboding is appropriate because a lot of bad stuff happens later. But what, as a kind of as a writer myself, the thing that I was most impressed with is the fact that this, this is stuff that happened close to 50 years ago now, and I'm assuming that Rada was a primary source for you in that. How did you tease that, had this story out of him? Did you just have to ask him, like, what were they wearing? What were they doing? Was it that level of detail? Did you use other sources as you were writing this book?
Absolutely. We had long conversations about just this scene and just this time. This is when the Khmer Rouge are coming into Phnom Penh. They're going to empty everybody out of the cities and put them into the countryside to work on the rice fields, basically. And so this is a really key kind of period, over that 2 days when they're evacuated. And so I asked him, pretty carefully, so what happened then? What happened then? What do you remember? What did you see? What did you smell? What did you hear? And some of the stuff, of course, I know they wore these loose cotton pants because that was the uniform of the Khmer Rouge in those days. I mean, it's pretty easy historical research, and that's what all the troops wore. He described seeing them. He could recall them in fairly vivid detail. And Rada often mentioned to me, actually, because over the years, he had a certain number of kind of stock stories that he would tell, to his maybe his friends or his family or to his missionary supporters, at church events, this kind of thing. But he would often mention to him, over the course of our interviews, over the course of that year, he would say how much more was coming back to him, how much more vivid the memories became over time, and he would, because things that he hadn't thought about in 30 years or 40 years, when he had to sit down and think about it, well, what did I see, and these things came back to him with, I think, surprising vividness. And of course, also that mentions his brother and what his brother thought and saw. And I did talk to Revy, not in the same kind of detail, of course, but we did have the interviews. We did talk about certain times and things where his brother came into the picture.
You're listening in on my conversation with Les Sillars, author of the new book, Intended for Evil, a survivor's story of love, faith, and courage in the Cambodian killing fields. Les Sillars earned his PhD from the University of Texas, and he also holds a Master of Theology degree from Dallas Theological Seminary. He has a long-time association with World News Group, but his work has also appeared in The Weekly Standard, The National Post, and Touchstone. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have more with Les Sillars when we return.
Hi, I'm John Stone Street, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. You can help us carry on the legacy of Chuck Colson by becoming a Colson Fellow. To find out more about this intensive one-year deep dive program into Christian Worldview, go to breakpoint.org and click on Colson Fellows at the top of the page.
Welcome back. I'm Warren Smith, and today you're listening in on my conversation with Les Sillars. Sillars teaches journalism at Patrick Henry College in Northern Virginia, and he's also a longtime journalist, writing often for World Magazine. We're discussing his new book, Intended for Evil. Let's get right back to that conversation. Les, the story is a pretty remarkable, on one level, adventure story. Just this amazing story of surviving and thriving, even in some ways, at least certainly subsequent to the time, and that how that experience has kind of given definition to his life. The thing that I want you to talk about a little bit, if you would, though, is just kind of this idea of the way you have, I would say, artfully inserted Christian worldview elements into this story. Questions like the problem of evil, questions like how could in a modern society, more or less modern age, I mean, this was not 500 years ago or even 100 years ago, this was, 40 years ago, how could the world stand by and watch 1.7 million people be murdered? How could the people that did the murdering actually do it? And one of the things that you say is that when you understand a Christian worldview, that we live in a broken broken world and that we all have sinned. It's just, it's really the more appropriate question is, why does this not happen more often?
I mean, that was what really struck me, was that when you start to do the research about the Khmer Rouge themselves, is that you see that, in fact, they were not monsters, all of them. There were people who did really, really horrible things. But I was watching like a documentary about the Khmer Rouge and about a journalist who had been a child when they took over. And then he went back and he was trying to find, and he did eventually find one of the Khmer Rouge leaders, Nguyen Che. In the course of that, he talks to all of these former Khmer Rouge soldiers and cadres. And, you know, since those days, they've been living kind of normal lives. You know, they've been kind of keeping their heads under, you know, keeping their heads down. And they've been, you know, living lives on their farms and rice paddies, you know, and sometimes in cities and whatever. And they haven't killed anybody since then. You know, they're not monsters. They are human beings who did really, really evil things. And it really did struck me quite forcefully that to be somebody, and Radov, you know, he realized this as well, but he's living in the midst of these people that had, you know, just months or years, you know, earlier had been ordinary people. They'd been farmers. A lot of them had been peasants, and they didn't start out to do horrible things, you know, but because of the influence of the revolutionary organization, they, you know, because of orders, maybe, I mean, who knows, you know, why different people did different things. But a lot of them really did horrible, horrible things and in the circumstances of the time. And, you know, it just calls to mind, other scholars have noted about the Nazis, the banality of evil.
Yeah, I was actually, you know, thinking of Hannah Arendt, I think, yeah, was who wrote the banality of evil, that these are not monsters, these are human beings.
These are human beings.
And we're all more or less capable of that. Again, another passage that begins to get at some of those issues, because there's sort of the question of, you know, the human heart and the fact that we're all capable of this kind of evil. But there was also, too, a question of questions of communism and totalitarianism and you know, the sort of the inevitableness of certain worldviews leading to certain kinds of systems of and structures of government. I'm wondering if you would, Les, start reading there and then read through this next paragraph there,
sure,
too.
Much Khmer Rouge ideology resembled, ironically, key elements of Christianity turned inside out and upside down. This was not deliberate, for the Khmer Rouge knew little about the Bible. Pol Pot insisted that everything about the revolution was Khmer in origin. Yet everywhere in Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge were shadows of biblical truth and practice. Love, worship, community, confession, transformation, unity, judgment, virtue, purity, equality, all hideously distorted. It's as if some alien intelligence attempting to create the most unchristian society possible distilled decades of totalitarianism from around the world into one ghastly system and then unleashed it on a small, unsuspecting country.
You know, when I read that, I maybe I shouldn't just immediately do sort of the apologetics or the Jesus juke, as some of the kids would say. But, you know, I thought about, you know, in part that, you know, Satan doesn't create anything. He only perverts.
Right.
He only destroys. He only twists. And, you know, the old, I think it was St. Thomas Aquinas who talked about evil not being something that was created by God, but it is the absence of God. It's the privation of the good, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that evil is what happens when people don't actively practice the good.
Since finishing the book, I've been struck by the pull of the utopian vision, you know, and this is what prompts totalitarians to do such horrible, horrible things. And it's why people follow them. It's because they present a vision of this world that is so much better than anything that we've got. And that's why when I talk about there, you know, you saw elements of Christianity in the Khmer Rouge system. They said, you know, everybody is going to be equal. Everybody is going to be free. You know, everybody will have enough. We will get rid of all of these horrible, you know, things that are part of the current world. We will get rid of all of those things. And that's the lure that Satan has. You know, it's to, you know, you can take the place of God and you can eliminate these things in a way that God has not decreed that they should be eliminated. God has decreed that they will be dealt with, but in his time, not in ours.
Right. And, you know, and this is kind of also a melancholy thing to contemplate. I mean, we can, you know, contemplate the sort of the depravity of man and the darkness of the human heart and the fact that we're all capable of this. But on a more sort of cultural and sociological level, it is a historical fact that the United States of America stood by and some people would say even contributed to the killing fields, to the situation that ultimately happened there.
You know, the critics of U.S. policy would say that the that the bombings in Cambodia contributed to the rise of the Khmer Rouge. I'm talking about the bombings of the Cambodian countryside in the late 60s, early 70s, when the North Vietnamese were running, you know, arms and supplies and troops up and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail through the Cambodian jungles. And so the U.S. unleashed this incredible B-52 bombing campaign that, you know, that was that these were horribly destructive. And I like to believe that the U.S. was, as much as possible under the circumstances in those days, that it tried to avoid civilian casualties. But who can doubt that there would have been many thousands of civilian casualties? And it's the anger at these U.S. bombings that supposedly drove lots of Cambodian peasants into the arms of the Khmer
Rouge. Do you believe that? Do you believe that that contributed?
I have no doubt that it contributed. I don't know the degree to which it contributed. The Khmer Rouge soldiers in the aftermath that interviews or that historians and social scientists have done with these people, you know, they talked about it, you know, and they would quote people that would come in and say, and I quoted one of the guys in my book that was saying, you know, there would be a bombing, you know, and then a farmer would lose, you know, everything that he had, all of his family, and he'd be dazed and shocked. And then he would come in to the Khmer Rouge and he'd say, you know, sign me up. You know, the American imperialists have destroyed my family, my life, everything, and I'm going to fight.
Yeah. And my recollection is that the bombings in Cambodia were technically illegal, right? They were unsanctioned, unauthorized attacks.
They were,
or at least early in the process.
Yeah, they were absolutely secret until they were revealed. I'm not enough of a historian of these kinds of matters to know whether or not for sure they were actually illegal. They actually started under Lyndon Johnson, okay, and they continued under Nixon. And so, you know, I mean, I think that they contributed to the rise of the Khmer Rouge, but as I pointed out in my book, you know, there's lots of blame to go around. You know, I mean, it wasn't just the U.S. policy. It was the Khmer Rouge themselves. It was the Chinese who supported them. It was the North Vietnamese who were using Cambodia to run the arms and troops up there anyways. I mean, I do have some sympathy for the American military who were looking at this and they're saying, well, either we bomb the Ho Chi Minh Trail or our troops who are in a foreign country trying to, you know, do something worthwhile are going to be, more of them will die because of this. I have a lot of sympathy for being stuck in that position. I mean, was it illegal? Maybe, you know, was it a hard choice? You know, it's war and it's a fallen world. And it was a terrible place in the world at that time.
You know, Les, one of the passages in your book that gets at that idea of sort of the banality of evil and the fact that we are all capable of great horrors apart from the grace of God is towards the end of your book, one of the sort of, it's in the epilogue, it's kind of as you're trying to tie things together. Would you mind reading this particular paragraph here on page 297?
Sure. Those surprised by the evil found in human hearts don't yet know themselves. And those terrified by the discovery have not grasped the grace of God. The desire for disproportionate revenge isn't limited to Cambodian society. Genesis 2 records how Lamech boasted that if Cain was avenged 7 times, he would be avenged 77 times. In a fallen world, sin is crouching at the door of every heart. The question is not, how could the Khmer Rouge be so evil, but why are we not all more like the Khmer Rouge?
Yeah. Well, it's a really powerful and relevant, interesting, and troubling question all at the same time, isn't it?
well, it is. And, you know, and there's a kind of a Christian political theory answer, you know, which is that it's the institutions of our Western society, you know, that keep evil in check, that restrain evil to a very great degree. And in other countries and other regions of the world, they don't have this.
And there is enough truth in that.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, I am not discounting that at all. I mean, I think that that's a significant part of the explanation for, you know, why some societies are where there's much more violence and evil in those. You know, I also think that, you know, it's God's grace to us here in the West, you know, that allowed the church to become as influential as it is, that explains a fair bit of it. I think that on an individual level, I mean, I think we should all be able to look at or to recognize that we are all capable of terrible, terrible things. As, you know, of course, as Solzhenitsyn famously said, you know, the dividing line between good and evil runs down every human heart. And if we ever forget that, if we ever fail to understand how thin is the line in each one of our hearts between, you know, seeking the good of other people and seeking to live in a way that honors God and to commit yourself to yourself and where that leads. I mean, if we ever fail to recognize it, that's a real danger in all of us. I think that we're misunderstanding human nature.
You've alluded to this a little bit, Les, but has Rada read the book?
Yeah.
What does he think?
He seems to like it.
And he's doing well now?
Yeah. He's still continuing his ministry in Seattle. I sent him a bunch of copies. You know, he seems happy to help get the word out about his story. I wrote the book to help him, in a sense, to get the word out about his story. I know that journalists do not, as a rule, you can't afford to send your news stories out to your sources to be vetted, right? You know, and this is, you know, when I was working through this with Rada, you know, I was clear, you know, I mean, I want to tell your story and I want to tell it accurately, but I'm still going to tell it as a journalist. But in a book, it's different than a news story. And so I sent him every chapter, except some of the last ones, you know, which were about kind of the more interpretive kinds of things. I talked to him, you know, I would interview him for a couple hours, and then I would go home, I'd write up the stories, and I'd send them to him. I'd say, here's what I understood you to say. You know, tell me where I'm wrong. You know, add whatever, subtract whatever. You know, and so he has seen all of the stuff about himself. He has seen and had a chance to look it over and tell me where I was mistaken. And so I think that he's pretty happy with it.
That's Les Sillars. His new book is Intended for Evil, a survivor's story of love, faith, and courage in the Cambodian killing fields. I'm Warren Smith, and we'll have a final segment with Les Sillars when we return.
Hi, I'm John Stonestreet, president of the Colson Center for Christian Worldview. Don't forget to mark your calendars now for the Colson Center's Wilberforce Weekend, which will take place May 19th through 21st of 2017. Speakers this year include Ravi Zacharias, Oz Guinness, and Rod Dreher. For more information, go to breakpoint.org and click on Wilberforce Weekend at the top of the page.
I'm Warren Smith. Today you're listening in on my conversation with Les Sillars, whose new book, Intended for Evil, tells the story of Rada Monicum, who as a young man survived a genocide that killed more than 1.7 million people, including most of Rada's own family. Now, let's get right back to our conversation. Les, I want to bring you back to Rada's story. We have from sort of these geopolitical and more philosophical and theological questions back to his story. Ultimately, obviously, he did survive the killing fields, and he came to the United States, and he had already been a Christian, but he got some theological training and became instrumental in leading the Cambodian community here in the United States, and also planting churches back in Cambodia. Bring us up to date on his story.
After the fall of the Khmer Rouge, he did manage to make it into the refugee camps on the border with Thailand. In 1981, he came to the U.S. with his wife, and he had one child at that time. And he started off in he was looking for job training. He trained as a welder, actually, but never found a job as a welder. And meanwhile, he was getting very heavily involved in church ministry among Cambodians in California. He was heavily involved in that, received some good training there, I think, and eventually ended up as a pastor at a church in Seattle of a Khmer congregation. And over time, he transitioned into doing more and more kind of missions work. So today, he spends most of his time in Seattle. He ministers to Khmer Christians in the Pacific Northwest and actually across the country at different times. He ministers with different Khmer churches. He also regularly travels back to Cambodia, where his mission organization has a training center where they do pastoral training for Cambodian pastors. They set up aid programs. They have a well drilling program, for example. They do a job training where they, one of the projects that was going on when I was there was to help train people to raise, I think it was frogs for market. Okay, you know, so they're doing different kinds of relief work, and he just seems to be busy. He's been involved in educational things. He was involved in the Phnom Penh Bible College. You know, he taught there for several years. So he's been a busy and active guy. You know, he turned his strong conviction that God had saved his life for a purpose, and he really threw that back into ministry to the Khmer people, you know?
I mean, the title of your book, Intended for Evil, you know, comes from a verse that what Satan intended for evil, God turned into good. In some ways, his credibility, his effectiveness in the, you know, as a leader in the Khmer church, probably at least in part, hinges on the fact that he went through that experience himself. He has more credibility, more standing with the Khmer people because of that. Is that fair to say?
I think that's absolutely true, that there's no question that is the case.
Well, and because of his word, not just his word, because of the word, let's stipulate for the record, because of the work of the Holy Spirit, operating through folks like him, the Khmer Church has really grown, both here in the United States and there, and in Cambodia. Mm-hmm. Would you read this one paragraph that sort of, in your book, sort of summarizes some of that growth?
Sure. No one knows exactly how many Khmer Christians were in Cambodia at the start of the Khmer Rouge regime, or how many survived. A fair guess might be several hundred believers in the whole country in 1979. The church in Cambodia has grown steadily since then. Christians now make up 1 to 2% of a population of more than 15 million, certainly over 150,000 believers, and perhaps many more, in about 2,000 registered churches. An unknown number of unregistered churches also exist. For more than 20 years, RADA has been a major contributor to the growth of today's evangelical community in Cambodia, a community that is, despite many challenges, thriving.
Yeah. Well, it's a powerful way to kind of draw his circle to a close, but also, too, kind of one of the themes of your book, which is that when we're going through difficult, trying circumstances, and we ask why God, it's partly because we don't know the end of the story.
It is, and it's. I mention in the book there's a quote from Viktor Frankl, but Viktor Frankl is, of course, famous in Man's Search for Meaning. That talk about, you know, how did people survive the Nazi death camps? Well, it was those that had a conviction that there was something more important than themselves going on, and I think that that's very true of RADA. But it wasn't a kind of a triumphalist conviction, though. I mean, RADA all through that time, RADA was, you know, as he watched his family die, you know, as he lost weight, you know, went down to 90 pounds, as he witnessed, you know, horrible, horrible things, he was angry, he was frustrated, he was exhausted, he was upset, he was angry at God, you know. His faith sustained him, but it was not a pleasant experience,
yeah.
You know. And so he can now look back at it and say, yeah, you know, God kept me alive for his purposes,
yeah.
And that's the faith that matters, I think.
At the end of the day, what do you want people to come away from this book with? What is there a single idea, a great story that will help them remember many ideas?
A great story. I want people to recognize that God can work in their lives, you know, and that they can endure things that they never would have imagined possible. You know, by the grace of God, these things are possible. I think that what makes it really come alive is really the anecdote that starts off the book. You know, when he's out in the rice fields, you know, he's been under the Khmer Rouge for 3 years. He's had it, right? He's come to the end of his rope. He weighs 90 pounds. He's lying and trying to sleep at night. It's raining. He's on the top of a termite hill, and he just says, "I'm gonna end it all." And he starts to sing in English, "This world is not my home." And he regards this as a suicide attempt. You know, he believes that one of the Khmer Rouge patrols is going to hear him singing in English. They're going to come over there and say, you know, "What are you singing?" You know, and he's going to tell them English, and they're just going to kill him. Okay, like, well, they'll shoot him on the spot, they'll beat him to death, whatever it is. This is going to be the end of him. But as he's singing the words to "This world is not my home," which is a kind of a country gospel tune, you know, they learned in his Phnom Penh church. You know, he hears a voice that says to him, "I have a plan for your life." You know, and he'd never heard of Bill Bright. He'd never heard of the Four Spiritual Laws. But he hears this voice. And he says to God, he believes it's God. He says, "Oh, yeah, if you have a plan for your life, you should help me now." You know, and sure enough, the patrol hears him. They come over. They say, "What language are you singing in, comrade?" And he, you know, and all he had to do was say English, and his troubles would be over. But he didn't feel courageous. You know, he didn't feel like, "Oh, well, God has a plan for my life. I must not die." None of that. It was just like, you know, he just lied. You know, he said, "Ah, it's nothing. It's just some sounds that I made up." And he kept going in those circumstances. And that took a kind of courage, I think, that is closer to my experience, or not that I've all been all that terribly courageous, but that's closer to many people's experience under extreme circumstances. It's not the kind of courage that, you know, that charges over the hill. It's the courage that says, you know, "I really don't understand what's going on here. I'm hurt. I'm angry. I'm tired. But I'm just going to keep going." And God saw him through to the end. There were lots of Christians who God did not see fit to, to preserve till the end. But I think that God preserved Rada's life for the good that he does now. And I would also like to hope for the encouragement that his story will offer a lot of people.
That brings to a close my conversation with Les Sillars, talking about his new book, Intended for Evil, a survivor's story of love, faith, and courage in the Cambodian killing fields. World recently published an excerpt of Les's book on its website as part of its Saturday series, which includes book excerpts and other excellent long-form journalism. To find it, just go to the World News Group website, WNG.org, and hit the Saturday series tab at the top of the page. Your membership in World News Group helps to support this program as well as World's other digital and print content. For more information about World, go to getworldnow.com. The producer for our program is Rich Rossell, with technical assistance from Michael Huckabee. The executive producer is Nick Eicher. I'm your host, Warren Smith, and you've been listening in.